afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. And we will bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Friday, April 2nd, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Oh, you got me there, Melody.
You were going to fall.
Happy April Fool's Day.
Oh my gosh,
is it the wrong day?
I wonder if I got the listeners. Do you think they think, what was she doing April Fool's Day today? And I welcome everyone to the program. You're listening to Financial Survival. And what a day it has been. The gold. I keep asking myself, is it going to pull back? Is it going to be an April Fool's increase today in the precious metals? But, hey, we had a nice day today, 2 days in a row. Go figure. Gold today is up $20 at $1,730. Silver was up 50 cents at $25.01. Platinum was up 25 at $1,215. Palladium up 41 at 2731. So I'm expecting to see a little weakness in the dollar as we do, down 27 at 92.92. Crude oil was up big today, 2.09 at 61.25, up $2. And the paper markets today, they're still filtering through. We had the S&P climb more than 1% to close above 4,000. For the first time, and of course there was a manufacturing boom, which brings more signs of inflation, but that's okay. The real inflation is our fiat dollar. Anyway, so we had the Dow up 171 points at 33,153. The S&P was up 46 points at 4,019. The NASDAQ was up 233 points at 13,480. So with that, lots of things are going on. A nice reversal. It's been very hectic today here at Discount Gold and Silver Trading because everybody knows the writing on the wall. Everybody knows where this is headed. Everybody knows what happens when you have trillions of dollars being created out of thin air. Everybody knows that it puts a weakness onto the currency and things are going to get more expensive. Doesn't matter how much stimulus you apply to the economy. Buckle up is pretty much. Put a lock on your wallet. And better yet, put a lock on your safe and fill it with gold and silver. So anyway, Dave, lots of things. We're going to skip and go ahead and talk about jobless claims are a little bit higher than expected. For the first time, claims for jobless benefits were a lot higher than expected last week, with 719,000 more workers heading to the unemployment line. That was reported today by the Labor Department. Last week's total compared with a 675,000 estimate from economists and, of course, was above the last week's 658,000. So we still see an overall trend is falling, which is to be expected now that the economy is beginning to reopen and about 3 million people are, you know, getting their shots every day. Still, the number of weekly claims still remains inordinately high by historical measures, and the continuing claims. Now, this runs a week behind the headline number. That fell 46,000 to just below 3.8. But we shall see, Dave. You know? And I think it's great, really is great, that we see a declining unemployment trend. But on the other hand, you might have this declining unemployment trend. It's a good thing, but wages, are they keeping up with inflation? Are they getting a lot of hours? Are they still working part-time? There's a lot of questions that involve that number.
It's true. I mean, the total amount of people receiving benefits also declined sharply by 1.5 million, in fact, but it's still at 18.2. Well above pre-pandemic levels. at the state level, Virginia, Kentucky, Georgia, California reported the largest gains in job claims. The report comes a day ahead of the government non-farm payroll count for March, which is expected, according to economists, to show a gain of 675,000 on top of February's 379. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, that suggests an upward trend, a trend that shows certainly a rebound, if not a recovery. I say we need more time just to see what happens next, because there's a lot of uncertainty that's still out there. The president yesterday announced a $2 trillion infrastructure spending plan that will build on over $6 trillion of stimulus relief already approved. That doesn't even include the trillions of dollars of Fed QE, or QE Infinity, as it's coming to be called. And as we mentioned on yesterday's program, ADP estimated that private companies added 517,000 workers in March. That's the fastest pace since September. And talk about manufacturing next, which also shows plans for more hiring.
You know, this all kind of reminds me like Bitcoin, when you have Elon Musk put in $1.5 billion into Bitcoin. What do you expect the price to do? And of course, it went bonkers. And you know, it's the same kind of thing. You put trillions of taxpayer money into the system, where a lot of people won't even receive the benefits of it. And you're going to see the stock markets and everything go crazy. It's to be expected. But in the bottom line, we're all going to pay for it, and I think we're all going to pay fairly dearly. And so, you know, everybody can be on a high now and enjoy it, because I don't mean to be a gloom and doomer, but it's reality. And one of the good things is a measure of U.S. manufacturing activity. It soared to its highest level in more than 37 years. Does anybody believe that our economy is so great for the past 30? And we said this in the last administration, the administration before that, the administration before that, the administration before that, that, and that. And so the highest level, I don't buy it. But anyway, economists say it's a clear sign yet that a much anticipated economic rebound was probably underway. The Institute for Supply Management said today that its index of national factory activity jumped to a reading of 64.7 last month, from 60.8. This is the highest level since December of 1983. A reading above 50 indicates expansion, and manufacturing really only makes up less than 12% of the economy. And the relief package that was passed in January, you know, sending another $1,400 checks to everybody, extending the government safety net for the unemployed through early September. Whew. Households have also accumulated about $19 trillion in excess savings that should be expected to fuel spending later this year. Dave, I kind of find hard to believe. I mean, does that include retirement accounts and so forth? Do you know?
I am not sure. I would expect it does.
Because that number sounds a little hefty for when we continue to read about reports where people don't even have 500 or 1,000 bucks in case of an emergency, or if they had to go to the hospital, but yet there's $1,900 in excess savings.
$19 trillion. Yeah.
In excess savings. Mm-hmm. So first quarter GDP estimates now is a high. Are you kidding me? They're as high as 10%. I want what they're drinking. No, I don't. No, I don't. I don't want those. Economists say that the overall growth this year could top 7%, which would be about the fastest since 1984. The economy contracted 3.5% in 2020, and that's the worst performance in 74 years. So, yeah, when you shut down the economy for how many months, yeah, you're going to have a pretty good rebound, Dave.
Well, we know that suppliers are already struggling to deliver materials to manufacturers, and that's pushing up production costs. Another sign, they say, of growing inflation. This has been most evident in the automobile industry, where a global semiconductor chip shortage has forced cuts in production. Now, the ISM survey's measure of prices paid by manufacturers last month also hovered near its highest since July of 2008. And its forward-looking new orders index jumped to 68 in March. That was the highest reading since January of 2004, and was up a little over 3 points from February. Factories also received more export orders, although those order backlogs swelled, primarily due to, how do we characterize it, big kinks in the supply chain. Certainly, the Suez Canal blockage over the past week exacerbated that situation. Now, analysts say there's still room for more expansionality, with inventories at manufacturers and their clients still lean. With demand robust, factories are said to have hired more workers in March, with the manufacturing employment gauge up to 59.6, the highest since February of 18. Now, you know, all this comes amid the most recent surveys of business owners that show rising sentiment as the summer gets closer. The Chicago Purchasing Managers Index came in at 66.3 in March. I'm not sure if you mentioned that yesterday. That's the highest it's been since July 18. Reading over 60 shows conditions improving strongly. Chicago BMI is a bellwether for the Midwest's economy and its growth. It's one of the multiple sentiment surveys to reach a multi-year high this month. There you have it, Melody. Nothing but good news, right?
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, you know what? I brought this up on last week's program, and it really does kind of get me going. So you're bringing it in again. It's worth looking at, and you're going to get me going again.
Go for it. I love that rant so much. I figured.
Is that why you did this? About the U.S. looking to provide currency aid to hard-hit countries. So, hey, let's just not bail out everybody in this nation to hold on a second. Phones are... Let's not just add, you know, stimulus to the trillions of dollars. Let's help everybody else, too, around the world. How about the Treasury Department that is working with the IMF to provide a $650 billion in currency aid to countries that were hardest hit by the pandemic? Treasury announcements indicated it's aiding the IMF toward an allocation of $650 in special drawing rights, and that's that would help build reserve buffers, smooth adjustments, mitigate the risk of economic stagnation and global growth. We can't have that, can we now? Special drawing rights, or SDRs, what they are reserved assets that countries can use to supplement their foreign exchange assets, such as gold and the U.S. dollar. Treasury indicated that the SDR allocation is within the level the department is allowed to allocate without congressional approval. And they take it right to the edge. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana recently had a heated exchange over the SDR issue during a public hearing, and essentially the agreement would allow countries to exchange their SDRs for dollars. Global demand. Yeah, I mean, this is just, I mean, it's just,
Yeah, these are the dollars that Treasury keeps in the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
That's special.
I call it a phenomenon because very few people know about it. I would guess that even very few people in the finance world know about it. It's a very, not secretive per se, but certainly well below the radar. And keeping these dollars in the ESF, they say, would in turn require the government to borrow more money and incur more costs. That's really the difference between the interest on the SDRs and the Treasury rates in effect at the time. The department said this potential implicit cost is much lower than the benefits of a strong global recovery. And it added that a strong global recovery would increase demand for U.S. exports of goods and services, creating U.S. jobs and supporting U.S. firms. Now, during a Senate hearing on how COVID relief money is being spent in the U.S., Senator Kenny challenged Yellen on the SDR allocation, saying it would be costly to American taxpayers, while only a fraction of the benefits of the exchange would go to poor countries. Kennedy said that China and Russia also would have access to the SDRs and that borrowing costs to the U.S. could reach $180 billion based on an allocation of $1 trillion in SDRs.
Well, you know, speaking of China, we basically mentioned the agreement, but we really didn't go into details about the China and Iran cooperation agreement that was signed last week to strengthen economic and political ties. Ron Paul, former Congressman Ron Paul, said that this agreement is a concern for the U.S., that these alliances are really a product of existing U.S. foreign policy. Paul says people shouldn't be surprised that this alliance. This is a natural consequence of aggressive foreign policy. What are we doing in the South China Sea? Why do we need ships over there, seeing how close we could get to the borders without them shooting at us? Why are we still in the Middle East? So much of the mess around the world is just people being defensive. And I guess I'm going to have to be a little defensive as we're heading into a break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's in the office for the rest of the program, taking care of client orders. You can call her at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Now, I'd like to finish up the story here that Melody started right before the break, quoting Ron Paul talking about this new 25-year cooperation agreement between China and Iran. Paul said the fact that they, meaning China and Iran, want to be competitive doesn't mean they're out to bomb us. If that happens, if that's true, we have to look at our policy as an our policy, the U.S. policy, as an incitement for that. Additionally, he noted, even if China were to succeed, it would be because of the failure of the U.S. to maintain its supremacy. Paul continued, if the Chinese can do that, that's not a reflection of the great strength of China and the evilness of China. It's the fact that we messed up our currency here. The dollar is weak. And that's not because the Chinese are manufacturing more stuff and selling us more stuff. Quite frankly, though, he added, I don't think it's going to be next week or next month or next year, and all of a sudden the Chinese are going to replace the dollar. But the dollar is going to self-destruct. Paul went on to say that a libertarian, by definition, is not an isolationist. On the contrary, he said, a libertarian is someone who espouses the ideals of free trade and open communication with the rest of the world. All I know, he concluded, is the more you talk to people and the more you trade with people, the less likely you're going to shoot and kill each other. Well, I can get on board with that, ladies and gentlemen. How about you? Now it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. This week's topic is a quick look at the difference in pricing between pickup or delivery. Your dinner, that is. It's a big deal during the pandemic, as a lot more people are eating takeout as opposed to in dining. But now with some of these delivery services becoming more prevalent, more and more people are getting their meals delivered. But at what cost? I mean, we're all guilty of it. You've had a long day, your fridge is empty because you put off going to the grocery store. Your stomach's growling, and you're too tired after a day of at-home work to go out and pick your dinner up. So, delivery it is. Food delivery apps like Uber Eats and DoorDash cost customers more and tighten already tight margins for businesses, but we've still come to rely on them more during the pandemic. The cost of the same meal can vary dramatically whether you purchase direct from the restaurant and pick it up or have it delivered to your home, depending on your choice of app. One example is from the popular Charlotte, North Carolina pizzerino Annizio. Say an order for a 16-inch pistachio pizza, chopped Italian salad, and tiramisu cannoli. I'm getting hungry as I visualize this this lovely sounding dinner. Well, let's break it down. The meal costs $3 more on the apps. The Uber Eats and Postmates take are unacceptable straight off the menu. That's according to Anizio owner Grant Ahrens. So it's very common for a restaurant to up their prices for delivery orders. Of course, there's the delivery fee, which varies from restaurant to restaurant, app to app, even day to day. The kicker, though, is in the miscellaneous fees category, typically billed as service fees, which brings the Postmates meal for those three items I mentioned to $58, about 45% more than the pickup price of $40. Still not cheap, but a lot better than $58. And don't forget the tip. I mean, it's been a challenging year for everyone, particularly in the service industry. So whether you're ordering delivery or pickup, a 20% tip is recommended these days. So add a rounded up $12 to the $58 for a total price of $70 for that pizza, salad, and cannoli. Hopefully you're splitting this dinner with at least one other person at home. Now, even if you're the generous type like me and add a 20% tip to your pickup order, you're still paying $22 more for the privilege of receiving your order at your door. My advice, suck it up, splash some cold water in your face, and cook yourself a quick meal, whether it's scrambled eggs, oatmeal with a piece of fruit, or just a basic salad. But if your fridge is truly barren, then just motivate yourself to drive the short distance to the pizza shop and pick your dinner up. Put the $22 you just saved in a cookie jar for the next rainy day, or save up to buy your next batch of silver coins. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, speaking of gold and silver, without a doubt, the big story in markets in the first quarter was the huge sell-off in treasuries, which had their worst quarter in years. Couple that an inauspicious quarter for gold, silver, and other precious metals, and, well, you're talking, well, thankfully it's the second quarter. At around 1.7% on the 10-year yield, the absolute level of long rates is still very low. Granted, but the size of last quarter's move was historic, and at one point, the whole situation had, you know, people questioning the Fed strategy and whether Powell and company were being tested in some way, requiring a strategy pivot, raising rates a lot sooner than what they told us they were planning on. But if you want to understand what happened to treasuries, take a look at a chart of the quarterly change to the too-big-to-fail J.P. Morgan Forecast Revision Index, the FRI, which basically measures how much economic forecasts have changed either upward or downward over the course of a quarter. In this case, the first quarter, the index just saw its single biggest upward quarterly move in history. In other words, it suggests, and I emphasize suggests, that the economic outlook improved and possibly at a historic pace in the first quarter. Reality is a lot different than that, but, well, this is just a measure, and I think it's only fair to hear it out and those who support it. I mean, think back to the beginning of the year. The virus situation was still getting worse, but at that point it looked like we were done with stimulus because the Senate was probably going to be too divided to agree on a new package, particularly, you know, $2 trillion. Fast forward to the end of the quarter, and we got historic stimulus, continuing Fed QE, QE infinity, the prospects of even more spending, and our vaccine distribution being one of the fastest in the world. Now, naturally, economic growth expectations have come way up over the last 3 months. Melody just mentioned that some, I believe it's the Atlanta Fed, projecting first quarter growth this year of 10%. That's insane. And so what many economists are saying happened in the first quarter was that, well, things got brighter. And the market just pulled forward its expectations for when the Fed would hike rates, which led to the Treasury sell-off, which in turn led to rising yields. So in that sense, it, you know, straightforwardly represents, as various Fed officials have said, an unprecedented improvement in optimism about the economy. But gold and silver investors know otherwise. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. I don't mean that. But we know not just to take these numbers at their face value. Precious metal investors know that critical thinking and persistence in their long-term vision, their long-term beliefs, are what will drive their portfolios in the coming days, weeks, months, and years. Also again, 1-800-375-4188. Now, I still have pictures of that giant tanker being stuck crossbound in the Suez Canal. And it's not just traffic through the Suez that's flowing again. A wave of data across Asia show that global commerce in general is picking up despite the resurgence of COVID in a lot of places. South Korea's exports, for instance, gained the most since 2018. Those figures are among the first sets of trade data offering an early snapshot of the health of the trade in the tech sector, which it's a key supplier for. Of the 20 major export categories that South Korea keeps track of, 19, all but one, saw a rise in sales from a year earlier in March. Improving sectors included, somewhat surprisingly, semiconductors, which account for the largest portion of the country's trade revenue. The March number also offer the first Asian trade indicators of the year free from the distortion of the Lunar New Year holidays, celebrated in mid-February this year. Well, here's a broad breakdown of the latest figures. South Korea's exports climbed 17%, again led by semiconductors, but also automobiles and steel shipments. Imports also jumped 19% from a year ago. IHS market PMI for Korean manufacturing stayed at 55.3 to match its strongest reading since 2010. Nearby in Taiwan, the epicenter of the recent global chip shortages, saw its PMI climb to an 11-year high of 60.8. That's leading the way among economies in Asia, following gains in China's official PMIs yesterday. And PMIs from Vietnam and Indonesia, they also remained in expansion territory. Now, the Bank of China, the Bank of Japan's Tanken survey showed sentiment at large Japanese makers of cars, electronics, and other products hitting an 18-month high as they turned optimistic for the first time since the fall of 2019. Not all PMIs gained, though. An alternative PMI for China, released today by Cakes and Media and IHS Market, fell slightly to 50.6, though still technically in expansion territory. And factory strength is evident in Europe, too. Purchasing manager surveys published today highlight mounting inflationary pressures in the euro area, with input and output costs rising at the fastest pace in a decade. While manufacturers are experiencing this surging demand for goods, they're also running into shortages and delivery delays. Again, these supply chains are having a difficult time coming out of a very difficult 12, 15, 18 months. Okay, so if you're an investor You've probably been wondering, has the stock market gotten ahead of itself? Well, that's the question traders are still asking today in the wake of a dramatic fall-off in a handful of stocks owned by a hedge fund manager named Bill Wang. Wang was making highly leveraged multi-billion dollar bets on companies, including U.S. TV networks, Viacom, CBS, and Discovery. You now know when those stocks started to fall, Wang's fund, the Archegos Capital Management, a hedge fund, was forced to liquidate the positions in those companies at any price. And both those companies, TV companies, ended up losing half their value as a result. Certainly lots of other companies involved. We won't go over them here. Well, we did talk the other day about the huge derivatives exposure that several too-big-to-fail banks like Citibank, JPMorgan Chase, and Credit Suisse had that were affected by the Archegos fiasco. I mean, I wondered about the silence of Morgan Stanley. Well, a look at Morgan Stanley's $647 billion stock portfolio for the quarter ending December 31st last year, the fourth quarter, explains why they've been so strangely silent as this scandal is playing out. Morgan Stanley held significant positions in all of the stocks that were being liquidated in recent days because Archegos couldn't meet margin calls with its bankers. The banks had allowed Archegos to leverage itself up, you know, anywhere from 8 to 1 to 20 to 1, according to some reports. Our friends at Wall Street on Parade say the fact that Morgan Stanley's portfolio held significant positions in the same stocks as Archegos is probably explained by the fact that Archegos had gained heavily leveraged exposure to these stocks, not because it had bought them outright or on margin, but because it had entered into equity swaps with multiple banks, including Morgan Stanley and others. As of yesterday, Morgan Stanley had remained silent on the issue, despite press reports that it was engaging in widespread dumping of its Archegos-related stocks in recent days. On Tuesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that Morgan Stanley had sold 45 million shares of Viacom CBS on Sunday night, ostensibly to avoid further declines when the U.S. market opened on Monday. It must be nice to be the big guys. According to Morgan Stanley's 13F SEC filing, it held 43 million shares of Viacom with a value of $1.6 billion as of the end of last year. We'll finish this story when we come back from a short break. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, Melody again in the office for this segment, working on client orders. You can call her 1-800-375-4188 or look us up online at dgscoins.com. That's dgscoins.com. Now, right before the break, I was talking about the Archegos fiasco in the U.S. stock market. Mentioned that Morgan Stanley held 43 million shares of Class B Viacom CBS stock, the value of $1.6 billion as of the end of the year. Now, how many of those shares were connected to an Archegos equity swap contract is unknown, and how much they lost on the sale of those shares is still unknown. What is known is that Viacom CBS lost over 50% of its market value between Wednesday last week and its closing price on Monday. Now, Morgan Stanley is believed to be under close scrutiny these days from the Federal Reserve and other regulators. According to the government audit of the Fed's secret loans to the trading houses on Wall Street during and after the Great Recession, Morgan Stanley was the second largest recipient and after Citigroup of the Fed secret loans that were funneled from December of 2007 to at least July of 2010 to bail out the bank's lack of risk controls on Wall Street. Morgan Stanley received a cumulative total of $2.04 trillion in cumulative loans from the Fed during that period. Now, Morgan Stanley was created in 1935 after Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act 2 years before that barred banks like J.P. Morgan from holding insured deposits while simultaneously operating an investment bank to engage in underwriting and speculating in stocks. J.P. Morgan chose to remain a commercial bank, accepting newly insured deposits while other partners left the firm to form the investment bank, Morgan Stanley. Now, the losses experienced by Wall Street banks after the 1929 crash were blamed on the reckless speculation of these investment bankers in the stock market, particularly through derivatives, and a leading cause of the Great Depression. Prior to the Glass-Steagall Act in 1933, there was no federal insurance on bank deposits, thus millions of Americans lost everything that they had deposited in the failed banks, or they received pennies on the dollar. After decades of pressure from Wall Street and others, the Clinton administration repealed the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999. And that allowed the reuniting of the casino trading houses on Wall Street with federally insured banks, one of the worst policy decisions, I think, made particularly the late 20th century. And just 9 years after that, Wall Street imploded in a replay of 1929, causing the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression, making the situation particularly dicey today. Morgan Stanley now owns two federally insured deposit-taking banks that we, the U.S. taxpayers, are on the hook for. According to the FDIC, Morgan Stanley Bank National Association, that's what the NA stands for, if you ever see that at the end of a bank, held $147 billion in deposits as of last June 30th. Morgan Stanley Private Bank held $94 billion in deposits at the same time. And more importantly, according to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, they're the regulators of national banks, Morgan Stanley holds a face amount of derivatives, listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, of $31.9 trillion as of December 31st, 2020. Does that sound like it's greater than the U.S. GDP? Well, if you think it is, you're right. Trading in the coming days is likely to give a better indication of how many high-flying stocks have been bid up by debt-fueled speculators like Wang. If the strength of the markets reflect robust underlying demand, well, then Viacom CBS and Discovery should bounce back. And other, mainly non-bank stocks, will be probably largely unaffected by the turmoil at Archegos. If stock prices are the result of a speculative bubble, however, just as our friends Pam and Russ Martins at Wall Street on Parade think, the implosion of Archegos is exactly the kind of catalyst that could spark spectacular drops in many other stocks that have seen impressive run-ups in recent months, and I'm talking about too big to fail banks in particular. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll keep you abreast of this kind of news that you don't find many other places. Now, just briefly, some good news. United Airlines told staff today it will soon begin hiring hundreds of pilots. That's a welcome process. The airline was forced to halt when the pandemic devastated travel demand last year. The Chicago-based airline is the first of the large U.S. carriers to announce it will resume pilot hiring. The latest sign it's preparing for a rebound and recovery. For the past year, we know airlines, including United, have urged thousands of workers to take buyouts, early retirement packages, and leaves of absence as they race to cut costs. U.S. airlines together lost $35 billion last year, but expect a steady rise in bookings as more of the public is vaccinated and feels more comfortable getting on planes. And I apologize, I'm not sure if that 35 is net of or does not include the bailout money that many of them received as part of last year's congressional and White House stimulus relief packages.
All right.
Can't finish this program without touching on infrastructure. The proposed multi-trillion dollar infrastructure plan that the president rolled out yesterday would increase taxes on corporations to pay for repair of roads, bridges, sewer lines, and investments focused on mitigating climate change. The infrastructure bill's tax provisions will be the Democrats' first full-scale legislative attack on a Republican tax law they've reviled since its passage in late 2017. But Biden's corporate tax proposals represent just a portion of the various tax hikes that Democrats have talked about adding to the infrastructure bill. And there are at least two parts of it. Some say there are as many as four. Coming. There's even a fraction of moderates pushing a tax cut for some wealthy households as part of the package. In other words, Democrats are going to have a big family conversation about taxes, and it might just get ugly. Now, the White House outlined its Made in America tax plan yesterday in Pittsburgh to accompany the first part of the president's infrastructure proposal, offsetting $2 trillion in spending over 15 years. The plan includes a host of corporate tax changes, mostly modifying elements of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that Republicans passed in December of 2017. The Biden proposal would increase the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%, still lower than the 35% rate in effect before the 2017 cut. Would also limit certain deductions and impose business deduction and impose a higher minimum tax on global corporations like Apple, Coca-Cola, and IBM. The White House said it will introduce the second part of the Biden's infrastructure plan, which will focus on child care, family tax credits, and other so-called soft infrastructure programs sometime next month. And that will likely touch the personal side of the 2017 tax law. Now, the president has said he would support higher taxes only on individuals earning more than $400,000 a year, although it's uncertain whether that figure applies to joint earners, which would obviously apply a $200,000 threshold for individuals. I'm sure we'll find out in due course. The White House did signal this week, however, that Biden dislikes Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal for a wealth tax, that is, a tax on the accumulated wealth of the richest Americans. She's pitched a 2% annual tax on fortunes above $50 million and a $3 million tax on a net worth of households and trusts above $1 billion. The proposal would raise as much as $3 trillion over a decade. I believe that's, I'm not sure if that's according to Warren's office, the CBO, or other think tanks. Even a weaker version would probably be useful if Democrats are concerned about the cost of their infrastructure proposals. Biden favors returning the top marginal income tax rate, the individual tax rate, to 39.6 from its current 37%, and also increasing the tax rate on capital gains for people with incomes above $1 million, ideas that most Democrats in Congress are said to support. He's also endorsed a more stringent estate tax, which is currently paid only by heirs to the wealthiest 0.1% of estates. But there's likely going to be disagreement about reversing the 2017 tax law's limitation on household deductions for state and local taxes. A handful of House Democrats have said that they won't even vote for any changes to the individual side of the tax code unless they get back the full state and local tax deduction. Limiting that deduction was one of the only things in the Republican tax law that actually disadvantaged high-income households. As Melody and Butch mentioned on yesterday's program, Biden's infrastructure plan includes $621 billion for roads, highways, bridges, and waterways, as well as additional investments to electrify vehicles, I think 500,000 charging stations across the country, expand broadband to rural areas, and in general make the nation's infrastructure, particularly the electrical grid, more resilient to climate change. On the human infrastructure side, it would spend $400 billion for home care for the elderly and for people with disabilities, $300 billion toward building and retrofitting homes, mainly for affordable housing, but also to encourage, I believe, wind and solar, and $300 billion for investments in innovation and research. Clearly, the proposal faces an uncertain path in Congress. Biden is unlikely to find any GOP buy-in for another multi-trillion-dollar spending plan, that's particularly one that's financed via tax hikes, even on an issue like infrastructure that typically enjoys broad bipartisan support. Democrats can pass the bill unilaterally with a simple majority in the Senate by using the same budget reconciliation process that allowed them to pass the most recent coronavirus relief package of $1.9 trillion. But doing so without Republican help will require near unanimity within the party. going to be an interesting next few weeks and months, ladies and gentlemen. Well, let's see, in the remaining time, I think this is an important topic. The U.S. isn't ready to lift tariffs on Chinese imports in the near future, but might be open to trade negotiations with Beijing at some point. That's according to new U.S. trade rep Catherine Tai. In her first interview since being confirmed by the Senate, Tai said she recognized that the tariffs can exact a toll on U.S. businesses and consumers, though proponents have said they also shield or help to shield companies from subsidized foreign competition, like so many companies in China. Tai warned that, quote, yanking off tariffs could harm the economy unless the change is communicated in a way so that the actors in the economy can make adjustments. Whether they're companies, traders, manufacturers, or their workers, she added, the ability to plan for changes that affect their future is essential. As trade representative, Ms. Tai will need to deal with tough issues both abroad and at home. She already faces growing pressure from U.S. companies eager to settle the U.S. trade conflict with Beijing. Well, looks like we have a conflict with time. We're out of it. But it sure has been a lot of fun bringing you the news of the day. All the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody and E. Butch will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. And please, please, safe out there. Bye-bye. Have a plan. If I got you, you're welcome.